to have a daughter who was passionately in love with his evening guest, David Cassidy. To be truthful, I was never entirely sure, nor possibly was she, whether the object of her adoration was actually David Cassidy, or was it the character he played, Keith, in The Partridge Family. Anyway, the fan hysteria whipped up around both was awesome. I really don't think there's anything like it today, honest. Only Beatlemania rivaled the Cassidy madness, and all four of them. Well, David Cassidy retired at the age of 24, and at his farewell London concert, 1,000 girls needed medical treatment. Four ended up in hospital, and one, alas, fell into a coma and died. Well, all that was 20 years ago, so what's he doing now? Well, he recently starred on Broadway in and on tour as well, actually, with Willie Russell's Blood Brothers, and he's now come over here to do just that. Oxford, Bristol, and now coming up into London next week, 11th of December. Now, on Broadway, his Mrs. Johnston, mother of the twins, was Petula Clark. David Cassidy was Mickey, and his brother Eddie was his real brother, Sean. And here are the two boys.
Hello. What's your name?
Michael Johnston.
But everybody calls me Mickey. What's yours?
Edward Lyons.
Do they call you Eddie?
No.
Well, I will.
Will you?
How old are you, Eddie?
7.
I'm older than you. I'm nearly 8.
Well, I'm nearly 8, really.
When's your birthday?
July the 18th.
So was mine.
Is it really?
We was born on the same day. That means we could be blood brothers. Do you want to meet the blood brother, Eddie?
Yes, please.
The kids out on the street today. Everybody's staying in me. Or maybe I woke up too soon. And I
Jerry Boogie Jackson.
Songs from Blood Brothers. That was a long Sunday afternoon, and my friend, and here is Mickey with me, David Cassidy. Hello,
Hi.
You were listening very intently today because you haven't heard it before.
I've never heard it. That's the first time I've ever heard it, and it's just out this past week. Funnily enough, I just finished in Bristol on Saturday night, and apparently was released, I guess, on Saturday, and a whole lot of fans had the CD, and I'd never seen the cover, I'd never heard it. And I said, so how is it? And they said, oh, it's wonderful. Haven't you heard? I said, no. We did a special performance at the Dominion Theater around Christmas time last year. They did a big awards show. They invited, it was kind of like the Night of 200 Stars. And Michael Bolton, Petula Clark, and myself, the Four Tops, and Paul Young, there were a whole bunch of different acts. Performed that night, and Petula and I sang our bits of Blood Brothers. We were currently, at that time, we were on a two-week hiatus from Blood Brothers in America. Mm. And we came over here to do this performance at the Dominion, did the recording, and then we went back to America, and they told us it would be out sometime around March or April when we were still out on tour. Of course, it never came out, and I kind of, like, gave up on it, and then my brother did it some months after he and I had ever performed it again, after he'd left the show. So he's never heard it either. And I was listening intently because I wanted to hear the arrangement, the string arrangement done. And it sounds very, very different from the way I've done it before. I like it, though.
Well, it's the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah, it is.
A large,
very, volume. Very large.
Is your brother over here with you, or
no.
Is it just you?
No, it's just me, and something I'm getting to sort of live out this fantasy and this dream, which began, no, I mean it, it's 2.5 years ago. I was in the West End only once before in my life, and it was with a play of, I would say, a lot less distinguished merit. It was in a play called Time, which was very successful, but From a substance standpoint, for me, this role has changed, I think, people's perception of me, certainly in America. And I really thought this might be my last go-around to have people come and see me in this show, because I'm going on and doing, I'm in the middle of recording another album, and I'll be going out on tour. And I mean, I would hope to and like to think that I will have a chance to do and play this part again. You know, whether or not that will ever happen, I don't know. So it's only 4 weeks, and it begins on Monday on December the 11th. And I'm here till January the 6th, and that's it. So for me, it's really like the icing on the cake of a fantastic 2.5 years, on and off 2.5 years.
Because you and your brother are the two twins, actually.
Yes.
And you're separated at birth.
Yes.
And it's quite a physical part, isn't it?
Very.
You've got quite a lot of jumping around.
Yeah. Well, he's... It's such a great journey. Willie Russell has written one of the best roles, I suppose, he's ever written, certainly for a man. I've only written a couple of this other place, but, you know, Shirley Valentine in Educating Rita, I think he's known for writing great women's roles.
That's right. Mm.
And in America, he's not really known. I mean, obviously they know Rita and they know Shirley Valentine. Blood Brothers is the biggest theatrical success he's had.
You have to age, don't you? You start off as a boy. 25 years.
Yeah. He's in his early 30s by the time we leave him.
Mm.
And he starts at 7 years old. So it's a fantastic opportunity to play this guy's life. It's so rich, and he has such a... In the beginning of the play, this guy is so filled with zest for living. And, you know, he devours it, and I love that, the energy that is in him and his enthusiasm for everything.
Fascinating. You have a Liverpool accent, even.
Well,
I didn't expect that.
You know, I think most people, one of the reasons why I think I've connected with this part, and in terms of the audience, is that when you see, and you envision David Cassidy, you envision him coming out as this guy, perhaps with long hair and perhaps with whatever you might have thought of him in the past. We all have a visual image of what we think someone looks like, even though we know we've moved on from there. You don't expect him to sound like this or look like this. First time I come on the stage, I'm in short pants with dirt all over me, short hair, and a Liverpool accent. You know, I actually have a friend of mine who brought someone who is British to the play, right after the curtain went up, sat them down in the theater, and at the end of the first act said, boy, wow, what a great piece of theater. Well, when is David Cassidy going in the show?
So that was that's nice. That's good.
And I said, I think that might be the greatest compliment I've ever had.
Well, you started as an actor, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I was reading your
I've always
CV.
Been an actor, yeah.
And your first show was directed by George Abbott.
Yeah.
Legendary.
Legendary. Yeah. He had worked a couple of shows with my father. In fact, my father did 37 Broadway shows. I grew up around New York. Contrary to most people's, I think, perception of me, I was raised around the theater and. Yeah. Have a very serious theatrical background. I was working with the LA Theater Company. I moved out to California when I was 11. And I think that's, I moved back to New York when I actually started working and I got my first professional job from George Abbott. But I'd worked.
How old were you?
18.
18.
Yeah, that's in our schooling, I know yours is slightly different. It's either the A levels or the O levels or whatever they are over here. It was our high school right before we go to college. I graduated from high school. Before I went to college, I was working with the LA Theater Company and doing a couple of original productions and working as a school guy in my last year of high school with professional actors, so, which was really, nobody else was doing that. And I think I got a great education and a lot of savvy about what I was about to embark upon.
Can I just ask a bit more about George?
Yeah.
He's a legend.
I'd love to talk about it.
He was 107 or something.
Yeah, I have a great story to tell you.
Tell me a great story about George Abbott.
He was 82 when he hired me. I was 18 years old in 1968, okay? I saw him again in 19... No, I was an unknown. Even though he had worked with my father, I was an unknown. In fact, I did the auditions under a pseudonym, even though my dad wasn't really famous. I wanted people to hire me for me. They hired me. I used my middle name. Anyway, they hired me after 6 auditions to do this part. I played this part. I worked with him for 6 weeks. Never saw him again. 15 years later, in 1983, I was on Broadway. Having become very successful and famous and all those things. And he was at that time 98, okay? He was 82.
Mm-hmm.
16 years later, he's 98. We were in the biggest theater in New York. I think it was called the Palace or something like that. We were doing the Tony Award show, and I was giving a Tony Award at the rehearsal during the afternoon, and George Abbott was in the very back row of the theater. I heard this as I was coming on to do my little bit, and now for the best play on Broadway, the winner is. And I went through the reading of the speech and walked. I looked at the very back of the theater. I could barely see him. I walked, jumped off the stage, and went up the aisle. And I got about halfway up the aisle. He stood up, 98 years old, at the top of his lungs said, "You see, I told you were good."
Really?
And I stopped
story.
In my tracks, and I wanted to get to my knees and weep and go, "I can't believe you remembered me, let alone you could see me, recognize me, and have a recollection of it." It was so, for me, it was such a great sort of, I don't know, cap.
So, in fact, you see, you'd have got quite a lot under your belt before the Partridge Family ever came along.
Yeah, I'd also done a lot of television the year before. I'd done 10 guest starring leads, and people will forget that as soon as you become, associated with something that had that kind of impact, like the Partridge Family. And for me, it changed my life and career forever. Okay. For the better in most ways, but in some ways, it made it much more difficult for people to take me seriously as an actor ever again.
When you first came to this country, were you known over here? Were you besieged and mobbed the first time you came?
Yeah, it happened right away. it happened the first time I stepped off the airplane. I was in fact, I was really very successful in America at this point. This is 1972. I stepped off the airplane, and I noticed as I was coming in from a skiing holiday, which I hadn't taken ever in my life. I was up in the mountains in Italy, and no one knew me. No one spoke English up there. They had no idea who I was. I got on the plane. I drove to Paris, got on a plane, got off the airplane at Heathrow, and I noticed there were all these blue lights. I thought, oh, that's funny, all these policemen. And I didn't even clock it, even though it was going on for me in America. I'd been away from it for 6 weeks. Mm. And I didn't think anybody knew me. Apparently there was 2,500 kids at the airport. Now, this is without really having a hit record, having been here. And they stormed, apparently, through, and we were running down the stairs, and I started laughing hysterically, because I thought the irony of it, having come from walking through places where people just couldn't have cared less where I was, you know, an hour before, mm-hmm. getting off the plane, and there are police running down these stairs to get down to the field, and they throw me in a car, and we go out, and there's hundreds of kids chasing me all over. And by the end of the week, I was staying at the Dorchester Hotel at that time, there was up to 5,000 kids out in front of on Park Lane that no other hotel the next time I came back 6 months later, wherever it was, would ever take me. So I had to stay in a boat in the Thames the next time. And it was really and truly quite extraordinary.
I will tell you something, David Casey. I wasn't a great fan of yours at all, because I was trying to drive down Park Lane mm-hmm. one night. I mean, I didn't realize it was 1972. It must have been that very busy.
Yeah.
Because the traffic was stopped.
Oh,
you just couldn't get through.
It was.
And eventually,
they used to
take us the following day.
It turned into, it turned into chaos, and my life in America was already chaotic. I couldn't get in and out of the studio. You know,
Were you really pushing it up in the laundry basket?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. The only way I could get in and out. I'd never come through the front of a hotel. And in the end, hotels didn't want me because I was causing all of this chaos. And really and truly, when I say I was, it's the unique timing of something like that. And I think the innocence, kind of the last gasp of innocence, people and audiences have become much more sophisticated. There isn't that kind of... There are still teen stars and they're still, screaming. But this was hysteria. I played Madison Square Garden, and they actually turned two limousines over. They destroyed six limousines. There were thousands of people there. White City Stadium, when I played there in 1974, they reckon there were 40,000 people. There were 40,000 people in there, and there were 40,000 people outside of the place, so that for a mile round, it was chock-a-block. You couldn't go anywhere. And they threw me in the boot of a car that was Toyota or something, to get me out. And it was like being in the Twilight Zone. I can only say that led to, 5 years of that led to me just saying I had had enough, and I had to get back to, I'd really lost my own identity, and I became this thing. The critics and so forth no longer come and review me. They come and review how many people were treated by ambulances and how many people had got hysterical and lost it. And they always, of course, would rubbish me because I represented all of those things. That
were you actually confused about who you were? Because
no,
I wasn't
at all.
But I couldn't, because I had a daughter who was besotted by it. And I couldn't quite work out whether it was the character of Keith Partridge or whether it was David Cassidy.
Yeah.
And the two were obviously, they merged.
Well, that was the problem, is that I was very, very different from the guy I played on TV. It was like a loon. I would go in there and be this simple, sweet, guy next door. And really and truly, my musical taste and everything else about, I was much more sarcastic, and I have to say I really enjoyed the comedic aspect of playing him, which was playing an airhead, playing a guy who's more concerned about his hair. I didn't really think people would believe that was me, but they lived and breathed it, and it was still a naive time And being young, being 19, and looking the way I looked physically, it played and worked against me.
But did you feel in your ordinary life, therefore, that you had to conduct yourself almost as if a scriptwriter had written it for you?
Here's what I felt. I lived a very secretive life. I lived a very clandestine sort of... because of the security aspects, I had four or five people that were around me that I lost a sense of reality, a sense of connection with the humans that I now have again. And I wanted that life back. I wanted to be able to go into a restaurant. I wanted to be able to go to a football game. I wanted to be able to go to a baseball game. And I wanted to be, I'm a big sports fan. People never, you know, imagined that David Cassidy could be that. People's perception of me was so different from what I really was. And I think that musically, people aligned me with that television character I was playing. I wasn't like that at all.
But it was also confused because you had your stepmother,
exactly.
Your real stepmother,
helped,
playing your mother, Shirley Jones. That really confused
me. But what really helped the confusion was that they owned my name and likeness. And they put my name on bubblegum cards, comic books, you know, lunchboxes, posters, pillowcases, all of this stuff that, you know...
Did you have any say in it?
No, I had none of it. And they owned my name and my likeness. Part of the contract that I signed at 19 years old, you know, when they paid me next to nothing, was they owned my name and likeness until, you know, 1974 or 5, when I got out of it.
So when you did get out of it in 1974...
Yeah, I ended it. The sad thing, in a way, is I ended a lot of people's livelihood. But I couldn't take it anymore. I had to say, that's it, and said, I'm hanging them up. Mm-hmm. And for 3.5 years, I really sought the dark side and was very lost, and it was a very dark period of my life and very painful period. I lost my father shortly after I lost my manager was really slipping away. She became addicted to barbiturates and was on her own downward spiral. And I had a very, very harsh re-entering the reality, breaking through the atmosphere.
How did you pull yourself out of it?
I think a sense of...
Because you must have pulled yourself
out
of it.
Yeah, I did, absolutely. I think a sense of, you know, I got involved in drugs and alcohol and everything else quietly, secretively, which probably was worse for me. Because no one knew that I was doing it. I lived this kind of very, you know, isolated life still, because I was still very famous and people still reacted to me. And I think that, in a way, I had to hit rock bottom for me to come back. And it didn't happen until probably all the way until like 1980. 3, 4, 5, I started to come back, and I really started to rebound. I started to find direction.
When you started to come back, I don't know, but I imagine it was very difficult because people's estimation, you would still be a 20-year-old. You'd still be
Not just that. They also thought, well, they forget that you ended it. They think, well, obviously he doesn't have any fans anymore. He's disappeared. Obviously he can't get any work or something. And I went, wait a minute, hold on. You know, when I left, the world was my oyster. I had anything I wanted to do, I could do. And I came back, I had lost all the sense of momentum. And people forget, in the industry, they want, certainly if you have the kind of fame that I did, you know, it's mainly a male-dominated and run business. And I've had to prove myself over and over and over again. We always have to. But I think when you have the kind of success and fame that I did, people tend to want to dismiss you.
Well, they'd love to pull you down, actually.
They do, yeah. They don't, especially, you know, if you become real famous and you're the object of adulation and a sex symbol and all of those horrible things that go along with that career that I had, you know. Well, he's a sex... I used to... Oh, God. You know, heartthrob. Oh, don't say it.
Anyway...
Because what it says is it takes away from who you are as an artist.
Now you're married. You're married to Sue Schifrin, who I take is a daughter of Lalo Schifrin, is she?
No, she's not a daughter, but I think they're distant cousins or something.
Because they're both musicians.
She's a wonderful songwriter, and she's been a great support for me and assistance to me in my...
Are you writing together?
We have, yeah. We've written a lot of things together. We wrote the theme for Rebuild L.A. when the riots occurred about 3 years ago. We wrote and donated a song to Rebuild L.A., which was one of our finest moments, I think, together. But yeah, we've written a lot. She's become much more... for me, because of my work, the balance in our lives and our relationship, I've become the guy who has really worked a lot and been touring a lot. And consequently, because we now have a son together, she's really been able to hold down the fort and be there. And she travels a lot with me. She's here with me now.
Terrific.
Yeah. And it's great. I mean, I have the best of both worlds. My life and my career has really, you know, it's had gone through such a metamorphosis that this is the way I always imagined it would be, that I'd be able to do the kind of work and get respect for what I do, as opposed to, you know, how many people come and see. I mean, it's great that people do come and see me, but to have the kind of opportunity to show my wares as an artist, that people respond to me now because of what I do, as opposed to the reaction that people have to me.
Well, it's also very nice to know that, you know, the Partridge Family is no doubt being played on television
everywhere.
Somewhere around the world.
Oh, yeah, everywhere.
And the records are still... We're just going to play another one now.
Yeah.
So there will be, you know,
yeah.
Royalties are coming rolling in.
Very well, nice. Yeah, it's just nice to... It's nice that people care and that you've had an impact on them, you brought light into their lives, and they still care to come and see you. You know, if you become a star, bottom line is, if you don't sell tickets anymore, you're gone. And it's a very cruel and tough world that you live in and scrutinized. And I've been very lucky that they've been very, very loyal and that people care about my work. And, you know, I think this is, for me, kind of like the crowning glory.
Well, welcome back.
Blood Brothers. Thank you.
And
thank you.
Have a happy Christmas.
And to you.
Over Christmas.
Yeah, I hope you come and see it.
Well, as a matter of fact, I should say this awfully quietly, I haven't yet seen
the
production.
Well, please come and see it.
That's a very good thought.
It's all at the Phoenix Theatre from the 11th.
From the 11th until the 6th of January.
Yeah.
Blood Brothers, starring David Cassidy. David, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Very good to see you. And yes, indeed, the royalties keep rolling in. Here he is. Remember this one?
The sun was in the sky and love was burning in your eyes. Nothing in the world could bother me, 'cause I was living in a world of ecstasy. But now you're gone, I'm just a daydreamer, walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again. Life is much too beautiful to live it all alone. Oh, how much I need someone to call my very own. Now the summer's over and I find myself alone with only memories of you. I was so in love I couldn't see, 'cause I was living in a world of make-believe. But now you're gone, I'm just a daydreamer, walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again. Life is much too beautiful to live it all alone. Oh, how much I need someone to call my very own. I'm just a daydreamer, walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again. Life is much too beautiful to live it all alone. Just a daydreamer, walking in the rain, chasing.
one of the many, many, many hits of David Cassidy. That was Daydreamer, of course. A few seconds off 25 minutes to 7 is the time when you're listening to Radio 2.
Hey,